Aloha, Paul. Beloved members of the institutions, dear friends, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome you to tonight's presentation, which is part of Serving the Divine Plan program. When the Universal House of Justice announced the launching of Serving the Divine Plan program, in its message of 9 October 2005 to the friends serving at the Baha'i World Center, it is stated that the friends can acquire a broad perspective of the cause, and if properly prepared, can, upon their departure, act as a powerful reinforcement to the progress of the plan in diverse parts of the world. It is imperative for the friends here to remain current with the learning that is taking place in the field, and to use the period of their service to strengthen their understanding of Baha'u'llah's vision for world order and the part his followers are to play towards its realization. As we are rapidly approaching to the end of the present five-year plan, it is timely we turn our focus to the progress and achievements of the faith throughout the Baha'i world and become more familiar with the activities that are taking place in the field. This evening, I have the honor of welcoming a member of the International Teaching Center, Counselor Stephen Hall, who will speak on the subject of the five-year plan. Mr. Hall will present an analysis of current five-year plan, which is now approaching its conclusion. And he will also elaborate on the direction of the next five-year plan on which the Baha'i world will embark in Rizwan. I have been asked to keep my remark about Mr. Hall to a minimum, and in obedience to his request, I will say only a few words. Mr. Hall was born and raised in Australia, and he was raised in a Baha'i family, as his parents became Baha'is when he was a young child. His mother, who was Jewish and German from Germany, moved to Palestine prior to World War II. They lived in Haifa on Mount Carmel, but they did not know about the faith. His father, a Christian from England, met his mother here whilst serving in the war, and the young couple married before moving to England and then subsequently to Australia, where they found the faith and became Baha'i when Mr. Hall was at young age. Mr. Hall is an educator and has done extensive study in the field of education, in curriculum development, and he has also worked as education consultant and school principal. He also has developed curriculum for the Baha'i children's education. He and his wife, Dicey, have four children, three sons and one daughter. Mr. Hall served as a member of the National Spiritual Assembly of Australia from 1996 to 2003. And for the most of this time, he was its secretary. In 2003, Mr. Hall was appointed as a counselor to the Continental Board of Counselors in Australasia. And in March 2005, he was appointed as counselor member of the International Teaching Center. And subsequently, he and his family moved to Haifa, the World Center. Please join me in welcoming Mr. Hall.
Good evening, friends. It's a great bounty to be here with you this evening and to have the privilege of addressing you on the most important of topics, and that is the progress and the development of the faith. I didn't mention to Manajay that not only my parents met in Haifa, but my wife and I met in Haifa as well. I know that's not unique in this audience, but... It's also not really a qualification for the talk, but I mention it more as a warning, given I've got four children. So. The youngest of who is not at the marriageable age. So. Friends, the task I've been given this evening has been made infinitely easier by virtue of the fact that we, as a Baha'i community, have just received, at the end of December, the message of the Universal House of Justice to the Councillors' Conference, which addresses the very subject that we're focused on this evening. And it's quite natural and obvious that this would be the focus of my presentation. And in fact, what I intend to do is to outline the message of the House of Justice, and in doing so, to perhaps illustrate it with some examples from the field, as well as some quantitative information in the form of statistics, which really, I think, paint a picture as well. Just a few days after the message of the House was received and studied here intensely at the Councillors' Conference and then subsequently at the meetings of the various boards of councillors, a few days later I visited the island nation of Kiribati, which is in the very midmost heart of the ocean, the Pacific Ocean, literally. Those of you who are not familiar, it's a tiny country made up of very thin coral atolls, which in most areas are no more than 100 or 200 metres wide. The population is under 100,000, yet the breadth of the country, because of the dispersal of the islands and the people, is 3,000 kilometres from east to west. So it's a vast area, but made up of very tiny atolls. Robert Louis Stevenson, when he visited there on his way to Samoa, lived there for 3 or 4 months, and he described it like as though it was living on a ship. It was so confined. But what impressed me so much in going there for a meeting of the institutions to study the five-year plan and to study the message of the House of Justice and to plan for the next 5 years was how this message that had been released from the Supreme Body had within a few days reached the very grassroots of that community. The friends there don't speak English, so it had to be translated into local language. Yet by the time of my arrival, just a few days after the conference, it had already been dispersed and was the focus of study throughout the community. Every single word, every single line of that message had meaning to the friends and was reflective of the experience of the friends in that community. Just as it was a few days later when Mrs. Huck and I visited Australia for a similar meeting. And it really impressed on me how this plan that we are engaged with is universal in its nature and universal in its qualities. It seems to me, beyond any doubt, that it transcends any cultural, racial, social, economic boundaries and differences. It may seem an unusual thing to say, but it also occurred to me that it transcends religious boundaries. We have people all over the globe from every single imaginable religious background joining us in this plan, becoming partners with us in the spiritual fragrances that it is releasing through the core activities. This had really a profound impression on me. And then the way the believers in Kiribati grasped this message. In the program of the institutional meeting, we'd allowed 3 or 4 hours for a study of the message. 8 hours later, the friends there were still studying it intensively, despite the intense heat, I might add. So focused were they, and so much meaning were they gleaning and gaining from this message. Before I focus on this, and I intend to do it tonight with a PowerPoint presentation, I'd like to make a few observations, very much personal observations, regarding the context of the plan and the present time. What I found in trying to summarise the plan is that that's not really possible to do. In one sense, it's very simple and to a very precise point. But in another sense, it is very organic in its nature, in its descriptive nature. It gives breath and it gives life to our thoughts and to our actions. And what I suspect is that it will perform the same role that the 9th of January 2001 message has played throughout the current plan, in being a constant reference point, a constant touchstone as we move forward in the plan. The 9th of January letter, when we look back at it, outline principles of practice which we have followed and adhered to, but it has given, in doing so, it has provided seeds of germination to activities and instruments and approaches that we never dreamt of 5 years ago. And it seems to me that this will be the same over the next 5-year period. Now, the two observations that I'd like to make relate to the context in which we were working. It's summed up by, what I want to say is summed up by the insights of that well-known social commentator and philosopher, Woody Allen. He made the observation that unlike no other time before, humanity stands at a crossroads. And one path, he says, leads to despair and annihilation. And the other path leads to hopelessness and utter devastation. And then he says, let us pray that we have the wisdom to choose correctly. Now, that would be funny if it wasn't so true, so I'm surprised that some of you laugh. But I assume it's because you're familiar with the 27th of December message, in which the House of Justice reminds us that we are engaged in a building process that is the one hope of a stricken society, that we belong to a community whose world embracing, continually consolidating activities constitute the one integrating process in a world whose institutions, secular as well as religious, are for the most part dissolving. It seems particularly important to me that we need to keep this vision, this understanding, always in our sights, because it explains to us and it has meaning as to why the House of Justice is asking us to almost single-mindedly focus on these key elements of the plan. And if we lose that focus on the critical nature of the hour in which we are living, then it is likely that we might not only lose the focus of the plan, become distracted by other things, but even come to doubt and to question why it is we need to be doing what the House has asked us to do. The second point relates to the orientation of the plan. We know that we are engaged in a divine process. We know that we recognize that we all believe and accept Baha'u'llah as a manifestation of God for this day. But we are also challenged by the processes in which we are engaged in. And in its Rizvan message of 1996, it seemed to me that the House of Justice was virtually issuing a warning to us about this challenge, where they said that as for the institutions, entry by troops will act upon them as much as they will act upon it. The evolution of local and national Baha'i assemblies at this time calls for a new state of mind on the part of their members as well as on the part of those who elect them. In other words, all of us. This was really impressed upon me reading an informal report the other day from Melbourne, Australia. One of the councillors sent in the comments of one of the participants of a study circle in a university. And in this study circle, the university, there are two participants who are not Baha'is. And the reflections that this believer shared was on how challenging it was for the Baha'is in the study circle to have participants who weren't Baha'is. And this is very typical of the sorts of anecdotes and reports that we're receiving here at the World Centre. I just want to read to you the reflections of this believer. Paul and Daniel, the non-Baha'is in the class, and this is in reference to carrying out the study of Section 2 in Book 1, where it requires that the participants learn prayers and then go and discuss prayers with other people. Paul and Daniel, the non-Baha'is in the class, were a bit worried that they would have to study a prayer with some Baha'is who probably know the prayer better than they do. That's, he says, is in their words. But it was a task they have taken on board, which I believe increased their determination to understand the prayer better. But at this point, Daniel managed to challenge us even more when he stated, if we non-Baha'is have to study this prayer with Baha'is, then I only think it's prayer for you Baha'is to study it with non-Baha'is. That should be easier for you, since at least they won't know it better than you do. This challenge created a fear in the Baha'is attending the study circle. But they had to work through their fear and accept this challenge, because they could not see any reason not to accept the logic in Daniel's words. And within the next 2 weeks, they had organized their friends that they were going to study the prayer with. What amazed me was that they are supporting each other in the study of the prayers. Again, he's referring to Daniel and Paul, to enhance their understanding. And they are meeting outside of the study circle hours to organize themselves for their service. And that is how non-Baha'i can manage to change the Baha'i community and push us outside of the box we live in. It's a small, but I think it's a tangible example of what the House is referring to when saying that the institutions and those who elect them need to take on a new mindset, to use the common vernacular, a new paradigm. Now, new paradigms and new mindsets can, depending on our disposition, make us feel quite uncomfortable, just as was reflected in that report. It can even seem threatening. The most, I guess, powerful example of a new paradigm, in a sense, is when a new manifestation comes. And it's invariably those who've got the greatest investment in the old paradigm who find this threatening, who resist, and who are unable to see the new paradigm's coming, who are unable to accept it. But this can also happen in our own experiences. And such, I think, has been the shifts required by this plan that it has challenged us. I can perhaps best relate to this personally. As Manajay mentioned, I have a background in education. And I can remember the glee that Baha'is involved in education responded, with which they responded on hearing in 1996 the launch of the four-year plan, this focus on the institute process, on education and on children as well as on adults. What I didn't realise at the time was how much my own notions of what education was and what learning was would be challenged by this plan. One example, if you like, is the definition of participatory learning. My understanding of participatory learning was that it related to the processes you employed as a teacher or as a facilitator in ensuring that it wasn't what I'm doing now and just giving a talk, but it was a matter of engaging the participants in the process. But what we've learnt about participatory learning in the context of this plan is that it means engaging in the field of action. It's participatory when the learning is taken and applied in action, and where there is no division, in a sense, between theory and practice. Later in the presentation, I'd like to say a little bit more about this. Now, the field of literature and research in this area of paradigms, and it was something that Mr. Lample referred to briefly in his talk, at least to Thomas Kuhn, who's well known for his work in this field. But the research and inquiry that has been carried out gives us some quite interesting insights, which I think can be applied to our own thinking as we move through the plan, and also in reflecting about the plan thus far. One of the interesting terminologies that is used is the notion of someone who grasps a new idea, a new approach, a new way of doing things very early, as opposed to someone who just doesn't get it or resists it, or it takes a long time until there's a critical mass before they get it. And this term that they use is an interesting one in a Baha'i context. It's referred to as a paradigm pioneer. And what is more interesting is that the research shows that there is only one determining factor as to who will or won't become a paradigm pioneer. And it's nothing to do with gender, it's nothing to do with age, it's nothing to do with social, intellectual circumstance. But what the literature defines is that it's dependent on one factor, and that factor is faith. A belief that despite all the messages around us, and despite the fact that we've always done things in a certain way, that we have faith that is the way forward. The literature also makes the point that, you know, this notion or this concept of paradigms, it's not a good thing, it's not a bad thing, but it's a useful concept to have in mind, because it helps us guard against our paradigm, our way of looking at the world, and the way we've always done things or things should be done, becoming the paradigm, if you like, the only way of doing it. And the literature then describes that someone who's in that condition, someone who, in a sense, can't see the wood for the trees and can't move forward and accept change, is in a condition of paradigm paralysis. Now, the final aspect of this that I think is perhaps the most useful to share is the suggestion that those who want to be on the cutting edge of change and always open to change, whether it be as an individual or an organisation, need to ask and constantly ask a question. And the question that they propose is this: what do I believe is impossible to do in my field, but if it could be done, would fundamentally change my business? And in our case, the fortunes of our faith and the fortunes of humanity. Now, reflecting on that question in hindsight, casting our vision back to the beginning of the four-year plan, and looking forward over the 10 years, it seems to me that we have been addressing the question of what seemed, if not impossible, then extremely difficult to attain then, and that is universal participation. Something that we've always spoken about as a community and always longed for and felt was essential. But when we now look at the outcomes of this plan and the level of transformation in terms of the number of friends engaged in the plan, we can see it approaching this notion of universal participation, of much greater participation, not only as members of the community, but in the action, in the field, in the teaching and consolidation work. The other question that might have been, in a sense, impossible for us to envisage achieving, but which we are now seeing come into expression, is the admonition of Abdu'l-Bahá for each one to teach one. This is really the principle, if you like, of exponential growth, of each believer teaching one believer in a year, who in turn teaches another believer, and so forth. And in fact, what we are witnessing, almost as though we're making up for lost time, is the ability of one person, when I say teach, I mean effectively teach, to teach someone the faith, to bring them into the cause, and then to assist them to become effective teachers of the faith. We are witnessing in cluster after cluster this happening on a larger and larger scale. The last time that I heard Hand of the Cause of God, Mr. Furutan speak, he spoke about this principle of exponential growth and Abdu'l-Bahá's admonition. And he had calculated himself, and he shared this, that if we'd had the ability, and it wasn't a criticism at all, it was a reflection, but if we'd had the ability to carry out what Abdu'l-Bahá is asking us to do and still asking us to do, that the whole world would have been Baha'is by the year 1939. This is this principle of exponential growth. The point in mentioning it tonight is that we are seeing glimmerings, tangible, practical glimmerings and examples of this potential actually coming into reality. And later when I share some statistics, I think this will be apparent. So it's at this point that I'd like to just turn to the presentation. And, I've got to do this. Okay. And to go back to the midpoint, even prior to the midpoint of the current plan, we're so encouraged was the Universal House of Justice by what was occurring in the community that it made the following statement. Let there be no doubt that what we are witnessing is the gathering momentum of that process of the entry of humanity into the cause by troops. Foreshadowed by Baha'u'llah's tablet to the King of Persia, eagerly anticipated by the Master and described by the Guardian as the necessary prelude to mass conversion. Looking at an excerpt then from the tablet of Baha'u'llah to the King of Persia, we can perhaps glean what the House of Justice was referring to and why it has so confidently stated that what we are witnessing is the process of the entry by troops of humanity into the cause of God. In this tablet, where Baha'u'llah talks at length about his suffering and the injustices that had befallen him, he then makes this statement: ere long shall the snow-white hand of God rend an opening in this dark night and unlock a mighty portal unto his city. On that day shall the people enter therein in troops. Even the terminology, we refer to the core activities as the portals. And it was Baha'u'llah who introduced, if you like, this concept of the process of entry by troops. But where do we look for this snow-white hand of God rendering an opening in this dark night? The snow-white building on Mount Carmel. The Guardian also made reference to this role of the Universal House of Justice in a message to the National Spiritual Assembly of the British Isles in 1951. This was during the two-year plan that preceded the 10-year crusade. This letter was in response to teaching efforts that had been undertaken in the continent of Africa. on the success of this enterprise, unprecedented in its scope, unique in its character, and immense in its spiritual potentialities, must depend the initiation at a later period in the formative age of the faith of undertakings embracing within their range all national assemblies functioning throughout the Baha'i world, undertakings constituting in themselves a prelude to the launching of worldwide enterprises destined to be embarked upon in future epochs of that same age by the Universal House of Justice, that will symbolise the unity and coordinate and unify the activities of these national assemblies. And this is exactly what we are witnessing and has been achieved. It's no longer something that is for the future. It's something, yes, we've got to continue working on it, but effectively this has been achieved. This was the observation of some of the veteran counsellors who attended the counsellors' conference. Their observations were that they'd attended many, a number of conferences before, both international conventions and counsellor conferences. They'd always been inspiring. They'd always provided impetus and direction. But it was always, in a sense, this is what we have to do. This is what we have to learn how to do. But what differentiated this conference, and it was so evident amongst the deliberations, was that we are achieving this. It is now happening. We have learnt how to achieve these things we always aspired to. A term that you will be familiar with is this concept of two essential movements that animate the plan. One of these movements, and the first of these movements, is the institute process, the movement of significant number of believers through a logical, sequenced set of courses defined for us now and referred to as the sequence of courses from the Ruhi Institute. The second movement, which receives its impetus from this first movement, is the movement of clusters from one stage of readiness, if you like, for growth to the next. And the manner in which this is done is not complicated. It is simply a matter of applying the learning and the practices from the different books in the sequence. So, for example, with Reflections on the Life of Spirit, we see devotional meetings increase in a community. After book two, or as a consequence of book two, deepening activities through home visits increase. Children's classes become established and multiply after book three as an outcome of book three. A further emphasis on home visits and deepening on the manifestations, the twin manifestations after book four. And now, as has been decided by the House of Justice, book five will be the focus on junior youth programs, and we see, and we are already witnessing, the multiplication of junior youth programs. The emphasis in book six then is on particularly the formation of teaching teams and the effective conduct of firesides. And then finally, as an outcome of book seven, we have more members of our community who can build their own pyramid, if you like, who can engage more people in this process of human resource development. So these are the two essential movements. You'll have to excuse my bias there. The teaching centre has given me Antarctica to work with, so it's a... Now, in this message, the House of Justice makes this statement that really encapsulates the learning and the direction. The most significant advances in learning during the present plan resulted from efforts in some 200 clusters. We are convinced that this learning can now be systematically propagated in every continent. And at Rizwan 2006, we will call upon Baha'is worldwide to establish, during the next plan, intensive programs of growth in no less than 1,500 clusters. We've learnt how to do it, we know what needs to be done, we are now confident that we can emulate this and multiply the number of clusters, increasing from 200 to no less than 1,500 over a 5-year period. I want to emphasize this point that the House of Justice makes about where the learning comes from. A cluster in an advanced stage of growth offers far greater insight into what can be achieved than one in an earlier stage, where the friends are still struggling to translate the provisions of the plan into action. It is to these more advanced clusters, then, that we must look in analysing the accomplishments of the community, convinced that their experience will be emulated by others as they continue to progress. Now, this is a change in mindset. Human nature is such, and society is such, that when we talk about plans, we often talk about fixing the things that we're not doing well, getting rid of the impediments, you know, identifying the problems and then focusing on them. But what the House, it seems to me, is saying to us, no, focus on what we are doing well. Identify our strengths. Look to those communities where what we are trying to achieve is being achieved, and then use that as a model to emulate. And this is a fundamental shift in our thinking. This was very apparent to me when I went to Kiribati, because in the current plan, that community had focused perhaps 80%, if not more, of its energies and its resources into one promising cluster. As a result of that, at the institutional meeting that we had, there was a model. And it became very apparent to those coming to this meeting from the other clusters of how this cluster had achieved the outcomes, where now in every cycle it's having at least 50 declarations. And it gave confidence, it gave insight, it gave the methodology now of how these 10 additional clusters will move forward in this next plan, by looking at the strengths, not focusing on the weaknesses. The House tells us that, in effect, we've reached a decisive moment. And why is that moment so decisive? Because the elements of the plan are crystallized into a framework of action that now needs to be exploited. In other words, we don't need to deliberate. We don't need to think what it is do we need to do. It is that we need to do. We have the framework. We only now need to exploit it. And at Rizwan, believers will be called to steel their resolve and to proceed with the full force of their energies on the course that has been so decidedly set. I remember when Dr. Jabahiri came to Australia a couple of years ago, he used this wonderful analogy or metaphor for the Baha'i community being members of an ark, of a sailing ship, and that what he described the House of Justice has done is to tell us how to set our sails in order to catch the strong winds. You know, there are many breezes on the ocean, but of course to get to our destiny we need to catch the strongest winds, the prevailing winds, and the House of Justice has defined this very clearly for us. The course has been so decidedly set. And then the message goes on to explain that this has had and will have implications for us as individuals, as a community and as members of a community, and as institutions. And this, in a sense, well, this is the framework for the plan, for the message that the House has given us. What the message does is to provide a record of recent accomplishments and then to set out how current approaches, methods and instruments should be carried to the next stage. And this is the framework that I'd like to use in going through some highlights or some aspects, by no means comprehensive or complete, but some aspects relating to the individual, to communities, and to the institutions, and then to look at what intensive programs of growth that are referred to involve. So moving then to the individual, the House have identified, as it did in the 17th of January message 2003, that it has witnessed initiative, resourcefulness, courage, audacity, consecration, zeal, confidence, and tenacity. These are the attributes that are being developed in individuals and through individual initiative as part of the process of the plan. That the institute process itself has given rise to a spirit of enterprise, an increase in activity in the community, and it has resulted in a concrete expression of the love and the vitality of the believers for the faith. They mention that above all, it is demonstrated that reliance on God confirms and sustains our endeavours. What I'd like to do is to share briefly an example of how this has actually been achieved. If I can find my piece of paper. One example that we received, that the Teaching Centre received, was, and these are very simple, but that's what makes them so easy to relate to, comes from Slovakia, where a believer was sharing her reflections on having carried out a home visit with a colleague of her husband's. And she made the point that she had enormous fear and trepidation and doubts going into this home visit. That she really, you know, couldn't imagine in such a conservative, what she felt was such a conservative society, that someone would not find this extraordinarily awkward. What is important is that she relied on the learning from the sequence of courses. And as a framework for the home visit, she used Anna's story, which most of you would be familiar with. She found herself during this meeting, this was the second time she'd met this person, of not only sharing this story with her, but inviting her into the faith. And this person accepted the faith then and there on the spot. She says, and this is from her report, "What seemed absurd to me a few days ago was now very natural. to invite a person that I see for only the second time in my life into the faith. I had not planned it at all, but my inner voice gave me a simple and clear command: do it. The second example comes from London, and it's the experience of a couple who were expecting a child and attended antenatal classes and took the initiative to invite the other 10 couples, as well as the midwife, to a devotional meeting. And this is the reflection of the husband in observing what occurred after taking this initial step, which took courage and audacity. The atmosphere around us seems to be different than before. Many things are happening that usually don't happen. People crossing our way two or three times a day in different parts of London, as if Baha'u'llah is pushing them towards us. People sitting next to us on the bus and asking if we are religious. I presume that's because they were the only one who paid their fare, but I'm not sure. Not sure what the reason might have been. But this spirit, these divine forces that are attracted to us. But what the house makes the point that this is not unique. This has happened throughout the annals of the faith. But what we now need to do is to ensure that the edifying influence of the institute process is extended to hundreds of thousands more. We need to think of this now on a very large scale. That individual initiative needs to be disciplined by an understanding of the requirements of the plan. And it was interesting to me that the house has referred to a posture of learning. In this message, it refers to a humble posture of learning. I think that speaks for itself. The final point in relation to the individual, just to touch on tonight, is what the learning that has occurred through the plan about the individual initiative of the tutor as a means of multiplying the active supporters of the faith. Now again, I'll use an example from Kiribati, but I think it's an example that in many ways encapsulates the whole essence of this plan and its distinguishing characteristics. If you've had an opportunity to read the newsletter Reflections on Growth, in issue number 9, there's this story of a believer in Kiribati whose background was a very difficult one. He was a member of a family, and all his family members were elders and very high in the church, but his pathway in life had taken them down the road of becoming an alcoholic and being basically the laughing stock of his village and of the community. Now, as a result of these processes that we've been talking about this evening, a teaching team of women came to his village, and with no preconceived notions about his receptivity or otherwise to the faith, and despite his condition, encouraged him to join a study circle. He not only found the faith and declared his faith through book one, but within a 4-month period, and these are the benefits of not having to work for a living, he completed the full sequence. And this is what is different about the faith. We've had many stories, inspiring stories, of people from all sorts of backgrounds coming into the faith. But what about sustaining their belief? What about deepening their belief? And what about them becoming active agents of change in our community? Now, not only did this believer go through the sequence and then become a very active teacher of the faith, but as it's referred to here, he became a means of multiplying the active supporters of the faith by becoming a tutor himself. When I was there, this believer came to the national office. He has very few possessions. He was actually carrying a pillowcase, and he asked the national secretary for 30 copies of book one, because this was the number of people he was about to start tutoring in different study circles. So he had gone from this condition of making very little, if any, contribution to society to becoming this valiant teacher and educator of the faith. The second example is one that I'll illustrate. The cluster of Manchester in the United Kingdom went from the stage of being a C cluster, one in which there was yet to be established a systematic institute process, to an A cluster in a period of only 12 months. And it was achieved through the initiative of one tutor in the first instance. And this is an example of the outcomes that, one person studied the sequence, became a tutor. They started a study circle. This is a real life example here of five people. So immediately we see an increase of five people into this network. Two students, after completing book one, started two devotional meetings with 10 people in it from the community of interest. So the number multiplied then to 25. One member, after completing book two, carried out home visits to five of his friends on a regular, consistent basis. So this sees the increase to 30. And this only takes us up to book three. It's not the full sequence here. But just as an example, then two of the students combined together began a children's class that attracted 8 children and 10 parents. And we can see how this multiplication occurs from the actions of one believer and the corollary effect. But this is this process, and of course what occurred was that a number of friends were taken right through the sequence, and then they themselves started this process. And this is how this cluster moved from a C cluster to an A cluster in a 12-month period. We turn now to the community. What have been the observations and the achievements? We've witnessed in the community steady multiplication of core activities, that it creates a sustainable pattern of expansion and consolidation. A statement of the obvious, but one that we need to keep in mind as we move into the next plan, of that we don't suddenly drop everything and start just focusing on teaching as we've saw it in the past, but we continue this emphasis on the multiplication of the core activities. The coherence achieved through the process of expansion and consolidation extends to aspects of community life. So what we are witnessing as an enhancement in the quality of the life of the community. And the message is very rich in describing this. Some examples of this is that the study and application of the writings has become a pervasive habit amongst a large number of believers. And I want to remind us here that we are talking about this cohort of advanced clusters, because the house has told us, look to these advanced clusters for the example. So I'm not necessarily talking about this as being a universal characteristic, but rather the characteristics of these advanced clusters. we've never had this in the faith. We've never had such a huge level of participation in an in-depth, constant, continuous sequence study of the writings. That communal worship has permeated our community and the surrounding community in these advanced clusters, that we are releasing divine fragrances as the world and society around us disintegrates. That we have witnessed, and the house refers to it as the graceful integration of the arts, not a forced integration, not art for art's sake, but a graceful integration of the arts, a natural use of the arts in the context of growth. The observation also that children and junior youth, where there are activities for children and junior youth, it strengthens the roots of the Baha'i community amongst the local population and provides then a basis, a foundation for working with other sectors of the community. That as a result of home visits, we are witnessing a greater level of fellowship, a greater depth in the quality of relationships amongst the friends. That there is a rise in the level of discourse. In other words, the subjects that friends in these clusters are engaging with are at a level that is more elevated than it has been in the past. That it is more meaningful. It is more related to our reality as spiritual beings rather than our purely material dimension. That there is, as I mentioned, this new meaning in social relationships. And a survey conducted by the Teaching Centre of 50 of these advanced clusters illustrated the fact that there was a qualitative improvement in the nature of feasts and both a qualitative and quantitative increase in contributions to the fund. The house also refers to reflection meetings as developing our collective identity and a shared vision and a will to move forward as a community. So what do we now need to do to take it to the next stage? We need to ensure that learning is woven into the fabric of decision making. That are the decisions that we make as individuals, as a community and as institutions are based on reflections on what we've learned. That we need to open certain aspects of community life to the wider community. And this should be integrated into a pattern of behaviour that attracts souls and confirms them. So we now, the house seems to me, is telling us, we now, more than at any time before, having embraced the wider community, we now need to be ever more mindful of the quality of our own behaviour, of our own spiritual existence. That we need, as a community, to focus on the single aim of advancing the process of entry by troops, not allowing ourselves to be distracted. And the house mentions that even the most well-intentioned ideas, when they're not timely, can prove to be a distraction. That we need to ensure that a preponderating share of the limited resources we have are focused on the provisions of the plan and not dissipated, that they are very much concentrated and focused. I turn now to an overview of what the house has referred to in relation to the institutions and the role that national assemblies, local assemblies, regional councils, as well as the institution of the councillors are playing. That their guidance, their encouragement and support has been essential to this process. and they play this role, as was referred to in the previous slide, this critical role of ensuring that the community remains focused. That they have learnt what it means and the challenges associated with maintaining a unity of vision. It just doesn't happen by osmosis. It needs focus, it needs attention, it needs concerted effort. To ensure that specialised areas that remain a valid and important part of the development of faith, for example, the work of external affairs, does not, however, distract the generality of the friends. That there are a few people who need to take care of certain areas, but the generality of us need to remain focused on the provisions of the plan. That we have witnessed the evolution of cluster agencies. And I want to say a little more about that. That the role of auxiliary board members is a critical one in that they support both movements, the movement of the human resources through the sequence of courses and the movement of clusters from one stage of growth to the next. That national assemblies and regional councils have learnt in some of these countries where there are advanced clusters to meet the challenges of large-scale growth, the administrative requirements that are there. And that weak local assemblies have been strengthened and that assemblies that have been traditionally strong have also advanced where the members of those institutions have embraced and understood the provisions of the plan. And this usually, if not always, comes about as a result of their own engagement in the core activities of the plan. So where does this now need to go? There is still much to learn, the House tells us, about the functions of cluster administration. That the institutions need to remain flexible in guiding the process of learning, to not see things in absolutes, and to be aware that what seems to be the right approach now may look differently in 6 months' time or even shorter, and to be flexible in allowing for the creation of new instruments as they are needed. In relation to this, administrative structures and instruments that are created need to represent a response to the demands of growth itself. What we have perhaps tended to do in the past is to create structures in anticipation that things would result from that. What the House is telling us to do, process comes first. Observe, watch, see what the needs and requirements are, and then when those needs are identified, put in place a structure or an instrument that meets that demand. I want to talk a little bit, because I think it's a fascinating development and a critical one to the forward movement of the plan, in about the development of cluster agencies and the administration of the teaching work at the level of the cluster. The House of Justice has made it clear that the administration of teaching, of expansion and consolidation, remains the most important responsibility of local and national spiritual assemblies. But it makes the point that the manner in which this responsibility is carried out differs than the manner in which other aspects of the administration work are carried out, and that what it requires, because decisions need to be made at the very grassroots of the community, is a decentralised mode of administration. And this construct, this administration at the level of the cluster, has emerged from the plan. It wasn't something that was put in place at the start of the plan. In fact, I can remember serving on the National Assembly and us, when this concept of the cluster came into being, having this natural reaction to say, well, we'll need to appoint a committee. We need a committee, we need some administration because this was our mindset. And the counsellors very lovingly but very clearly encouraged us to think that let's wait and see. Let's see what the needs are. Let's leave it with the friends and see what emerges. Now, I'm sure if at that point we'd put in place a structure, it wouldn't have looked anything like this. Well, I hope not. It would have been... It is something that has emerged from experience. Oops. Okay. We have this cluster trio. In Russia, they call it a troika. I'm not sure what they call it in Sicily, but I could guess. And it's a group of three, essentially. It's the cluster institute coordinator, the cluster growth facilitator, who works and carries out on a day-to-day basis the work of the area teaching committee, and the auxiliary board member. And the manner in which they operate is defined by the house in the message, that each acts within a well-defined sphere, but with complete unity and harmony, which is essential. So they have a defined sphere of action. They also work together in a harmonious way, and communication between them is essential. They meet regularly in order to assess the pace of growth in the cluster, to identify new opportunities and special needs of the cluster, to devise new strategies to meet the challenges of growth, and to prepare for the reflection meetings. A particular point in reference to auxiliary board members is they work on both fronts to ensure that the two movements which have come to characterise the process of growth proceed unhampered. And this has again been part of the mindset change of this plan, the role of the institution of the counsellors, of auxiliary board members, and of their assistants. The message, in a sense, gives this mandate to the auxiliary board members and to the counsellors, a few highlights of which are: in addressing the counsellors, the House has said that you and your auxiliaries are urged to exert every effort in the coming years to ensure that in cluster after cluster, learning is woven into the fabric of decision making. One of your primary concerns will be to strengthen appreciation for systematic action, already heightened by the successes it has brought. Perhaps the task that will occupy the attention of you and your auxiliaries above all others is to assist the community in its effort to maintain focus, and you will want to take every opportunity to reinforce the disposition to prioritise. When you read this mandate and this expectation of the House, it is not a passive role. It is not a role of simply giving talks and trying to inspire the friends. It's working with the friends and by example demonstrating leadership. And this is part of the new mindset. Friends, I'm really conscious of the time, and I'm actually going to skip this section on intensive programs of growth because I'm conscious that I'm going to go over time. I'm a very poor judge of these things, so you'll just excuse me for a minute. This is... I will perhaps just look at this aspect of it, and that is that an intensive program of growth involves these four stages of training, movement of human resources through the sequence of courses, of community building, which is achieved through the multiplication of the core activities, and as represented by the outer circle, the engagement of the wider community. Once a critical number, and it seems to be around 40 or 50 friends have been through the full sequence, once that has been achieved, the conditions tend to be ripe for an intensive focus on teaching. And then as this cycle continues and expands, we see that growth occurs. And one of the new mindsets of this planet was certainly a shift in thinking for me, is that once this pattern is established, it is possible to act systematically to increase its effectiveness. In a sense, what that is saying is that quality can be achieved through quantity, that we need to first focus on the movement, and we can't afford to get bogged down in losing sleep over necessarily, you know, are we doing it in the most perfect way? Are our tutors the most perfect of tutors? You know, are the people conducting children's classes doing it in the most perfect way? What has been observed in these advanced clusters is that, in fact, quality emerges from practice and from quantity. This is demonstrated by the observations in the Broward County cluster in Florida, where they observed that in the initial cycles or the initial stages of engaging the community of interest in study circles, that approximately 1 in 5 after completing or during book one, during the course of book one, 1 in 5 of these people would declare. That rate has gone, as the process and the cycles have increased, the ratio now is much higher. And this reflects a qualitative dimension as a result of persevering and increasing these cycles. This is a very fast-forward view of an intensive program of growth. Just come and see Mrs. Huck, she'll explain it to you. So. Also, the message goes through different stages of an intensive programs of growth. Sorry about this. But one area I did want to focus on, and the last point, was about junior youth, the importance of junior youth. One example of this that is a very powerful one comes from Mongolia, where 3 years ago the Friends decided to focus on the development of junior youth amongst a number of clusters. It began with 58 youth, essentially youth, coming together and training as junior youth animators. I'm not sure if the term was used then, it was 3 years ago, but nevertheless they came together and their aim was to establish junior youth programs in a number of clusters. Now, a number of these youth committed themselves over the long term, over this 3-year period, to multiplying the junior youth programs by devoting their holidays to going to these clusters and establishing a junior youth program in an urban area and one in a rural setting, and that throughout the year they supported this development. Now, 3 years later, in one of these clusters, junior youth program has reached and been made available to every single junior youth living in that cluster. Now, I'm not talking about the Baha'i community, I'm talking about the wider community. And this is the sort of potential and the scale that junior youth programs are achieving. And I want to emphasise it particularly tonight, because the other observation is that it is the youth, it is the young people who are most effective at working with junior youth. I also want to explore the question just for a moment of why are junior youth seemingly so receptive, or not seemingly, why are they so receptive to the faith, to spiritual influences? Some studies carried out in the States actually identified that at this age, the level of receptivity, for example, to devotional experience is twice as heightened as it is in adults. And that the areas of the brain that appear to be hardwired to explore questions about the meaning of life and what happens after we die are the same parts of the brain that, if you like, are used or come alive through devotional and spiritual experience. And this group of social scientists and neurosurgeons and youth workers who had no investment in religious agenda identified that what was needed more than anything else for adolescents was spiritual nourishment. What they also needed was what they described as authoritative communities, and that the antisocial behaviour was effectively an outcome of a lack of authoritative community or belonging to authoritative community. This diagram, as an interesting aside, well, I find it interesting, also holds a key to why junior youth are so perhaps so receptive to the faith. It was an experiment carried out by Edward de Bono, who works in the field of lateral thinking. He simply showed this diagram of a unusual-looking wheelbarrow to different groups of people, and he asked them to comment, to simply comment, and then he recorded and observed their comments. And their comments fell into two types. One were criticisms of the wheelbarrow, which you can understand, and the other were comments that reflected something interesting, a new insight or an open-mindedness. Now, he first did this with the groups that he did this with were a group of executives. Then he carried it out with a group of people with an IQ of over 140. The third group were a group of teachers, and the fourth group were a group of 12 and 13-year-olds. Now, the ratio of critical comments, negative comments, to comments that expressed interest amongst the group of executives was 20 to 1. In other words, for every one comment that reflected interest, there were 20 comments that said, no, that's useless, that, you know, that they were critical of it. For the group of 140 IQ or over, the ratio was even higher. It was 22 to 1. And sad to say, the group of teachers was higher still. It was 27 to 1. But the group of 12 and 13-year-olds, the ratio was 2 to 1. In other words, it demonstrated not only that 12 and 13-year-olds don't push wheelbarrows, but that they are very much more open-minded to new ideas, new possibilities, new ways of looking at things. Oh, gosh, I've judged this badly. Friends, I'm going to move to a section now on quantitative indicators of growth. If we look at the growth in the number of study circles, and now we're looking essentially at global figures, we can see how exponential, in fact, the growth has been. In April 2001, at the outset of the plan, these were the relative numbers who had completed sequence of courses as a result of the 4-year plan and the 12-month plan. By last October, we had seen this level of growth. And by October 2005, a further increment. And across the 5-year plan, we have witnessed 2.5 times increase in the number completing Book 1, going up to 51 times, or 5,152% of completing who've completed Book 7. So you can see these results are extremely encouraging in terms of the movement of human resources on a global scale through the sequence of courses. The current numbers also reflect this growth. In April 2001, we had, at that point in time, just over 3,000 believers, and at that stage we hadn't particularly grasped the concept of inviting the community of interest into the study circles. But we can now see that in October, at that point in time, there are 11,000 study circles occurring. And what's particularly significant is that 33% of those are members of the wider community. So one third of the participants in our study circles are not yet Baha'is. This is a very, very healthy statistic. And that it represents throughout the plan a 3.5 times increase in the number of, in our capacity to establish study circles. In terms of children's classes and junior youth programs, we see similar sorts of progress being made. In April 2001, we had approximately 4,000 children's classes established. By October 2005, this had increased to over 10,000. And whilst we didn't have the numbers back in 2001, we can see that over 56%, or over 50%, of those children attending children's classes were from the wider community. That in junior youth programs that we hadn't really identified as such in 2001, and it's something that has emerged from the plan, we see similar sorts of rates of increase. In fact, 58% of those attending junior youth programs are from the wider community. And combined, we see that the relationship between the beginning of the plan and the end has been more than a threefold increase in the number of participants, in the number, not participants, but in the number of actual classes for children and junior youth. So this gives a feel for the health of our community and the vitality of our community. Devotional meetings, again, similar sorts of statistics. A sixfold increase in the number of devotional meetings throughout the plan, 30% of which are attended by members of the wider community. Now, how are we going to achieve this goal of no less than 1,500 clusters? Was this just a number plucked out in hopeful anticipation? Or was it based on learning and experience and indicators of this plan? The answer to that becomes evident when we look firstly at where we were approximately 1.5 years into the plan. We had 30 A clusters, just under 1,000 B clusters, just over 5,000 C clusters, 10,000 D clusters, totaling approximately 16,500 clusters worldwide. Now, that number has fluctuated because the boundaries of clusters have changed during this period. But nevertheless, we can see that by October 2004, there'd been a highly significant increase in the number of A clusters because of the movement of B clusters to that stage of readiness, but also the movement of C clusters to the B stage, if not the A stage of readiness. And then by February, as we speak, we have 256. It's doubled since October 2004, the number of A clusters. That virtually represents the number of intensive programs of growth. It's a little less than that, approximately 240. But the question is, how will we move from this stage to, by April 2011, having no less than 1,500 intensive programs of growth or clusters with intensive programs of growth? If we take the current A clusters and we add the B clusters, which are all well within reach, or many of which are well within reach of reaching that stage. And then we look at the number of sea clusters which have a significant population of 100 or more believers. We can see that that totals well over the goal. So it's a very realistic, tangible projection and goal that the House of Justice has given us. If we project that then to April 2011, we not only see that there's been a movement to a significant movement to the A clusters, but what will naturally follow as a consequence is that there'll be many of the other clusters also advancing, so that when we enter the next plan, we'll have an even larger cohort that will move to this stage of intensive growth. These figures there are purely to illustrate that point, not goals in any way, shape or form. One thing I've observed, particularly in visiting countries and in speaking to the pilgrims, is the issue of enrolments. And it's, I believe, too early in the plan to be thinking about this in terms of global trends. But keeping in mind that the House of Justice has encouraged us and has focused us on clusters in the advanced stage of development, we can perhaps glean some insights to the trends in enrolments. If we take clusters that represent two types that the House identifies, the first three in Cambodia, Mongolia and India represent clusters that are established in communities where in general there is a very receptive population. The clusters below that in the United Kingdom and the USA are typical and representative of clusters where the level of receptivity is not as apparent. What we can see from this are a number of things. The number of friends who've moved through the sequence, what the population was when each of these started their first intensive program of growth, and then what their current population now is. These have been different time frames. Some have been over a 3-year period or more. Some have been only over a 12-month period or less. So this then it translates, however, into a percentage increase in Baha'i population per annum when you divide it by the number of months or years. Now, again, making an emphasis that this is just an example of the top echelon, if you like, of clusters in these two groups, we can perhaps do some projections on the basis that we would sustain this level of growth in these communities. And I'll just go through these figures. The reason for the one in India being underlined is that that's the whole population of that cluster. So it's now, of course, there'll be lots of things that intervene with this. I guess on the top group, we might find it more and more difficult, find fewer, the receptivity perhaps isn't sustained, because we're talking there about getting to mass conversion, which, of course, we don't anticipate in this plan. But on the other side, what the House tells us is that in clusters where there isn't such great receptivity, that what's been observed as the cycles increased and the momentum is sustained, we become more skilled, and as the forces of the major plan take effect, there is a greater level of effectiveness in teaching. And we can see just that sample of what is potentially possible, that of 5,000 has increased in those clusters to over 11,000, and what the principle of exponential growth. The reason the House of Justice also mentioned to the National Assembly, one National Assembly, in this case the United States, that if some 200 or 300 clusters were to achieve the level of activity already reached in Austin and Broward clusters, the present rate of enrolments could multiply tenfold. This is not an abstract possibility, but a practical objective that lies well within your grasp. And the reason, I think, is for confidence in this is this column, that where the human resources are continually developed and this pyramid continues to grow, as has been obvious in these clusters, that we see this potential realised. And this is the point that the House makes here, that when human resources increase in a manner proportionate to the rise in the overall Baha'i population from cycle to cycle, it is possible not only to sustain but to accelerate growth. If we look at principles of exponential growth, we can see this. If we look at an example of linear growth, and in terms of Baha'i experience, this is a pretty positive example in terms of a community growing from 20 believers in 1 year to 10 years later to 120 through increments, some years more than others. But if you take the principle of exponential growth and this potential for each one to teach one, you can see that in the first number of years, the growth isn't as high, in fact, but it rapidly begins to outweigh linear growth. This graph describes that visually, and this is typical of exponential growth, that in the initial stages, it is not as apparent, it's not as rapid as linear growth, but then it takes a rapid rise, a rapid increase. The final point, friends, and the final note to end on is the emphasis that the House of Justice places on this plan being a spiritual enterprise. That, yes, it's to do with instruments and methodologies and strategies, but we should never forget that at its heart and by means of its animation, it is a spiritual enterprise. The House has said to us that the Councillors' Conference, we ask that you take every opportunity to convey to the community, to them, our confidence in their capacity to overcome the obstacles that will inevitably appear in their path. So, just like any other spiritual enterprise or undertaking, we know that we will be tested along this journey. Above all, the friends need to remain ever conscious of the magnitude of the spiritual forces that are at their disposition. And remind them that they are the illumined souls envisioned by Abdu'l-Bahá in his prayer. Heroes are they, O my Lord. Lead them to the field of battle. Guides are they. Make them to speak out with arguments and proofs. Ministering servants are they. Cause them to pass round the cup that brimmeth with the wine of certitude. O my God, make them to be songsters that carol in fair gardens. Make them lions that couch in the thickets, whales that plunge in the vasty deeps. Thank you very much.
On behalf of all of us present tonight, I would like to thank Mr. Hall for this most wonderful, informative, inspiring, enriching presentation. Please join me again to thank Mr. Hall. I have been asked to remind the friends who will be participating in the full program that there will be 3 workshops offered tomorrow. The first in the series of the World Order Workshop, focusing on the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, will be offered by Mr. Hooper Dunbar here in the auditorium. Participants are asked to have a copy of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah with them. For the Global Plan workshops, one group will begin the series with fundamental concepts with Mr. Paul Lampel in the multipurpose room of the International Teaching Center building, and another group will participate in the 4th workshop of the series entitled The Unfoldment of the Divine Plan with Mr. Grossman in the far end of the dining room. The friends in Fundamental Concept Workshop will need a copy of Book 1 of the Ruhi Institute for the afternoon session, and those in the Unfoldment of the Divine Plan should bring a copy of Book 4 as well as a copy of the Tablets of the Divine Plan. Participants may confirm which workshop they are attending on the program's website on the infobox. As always, a light lunch will be provided tomorrow for the participants. We will all come back together on Friday evening, 24th March, when Mr. Kaiser Barnes will speak to us on the topic of justice. Please join us in the dining room for refreshment following the closing prayer.